You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, why do people roll their eyes at food trends like cupcakes, frozen yogurt, and pumpkin spice lattes? Our guest says it's because there's a double standard when it comes to some kinds of food. Right now, controversy around oil pipelines often involves environmental concerns, but when a pipeline is being built, private property rights can also be a point of contention. Here in Wisconsin, Canadian energy company Enbridge has reached agreements with property owners to run pipelines through their land, but in some cases, the company can harness the state's power of eminent domain. A recent change in state law makes it easier for Enbridge to use that power as the company looks at a possible expansion in the state. Dan Egan is a reporter covering the Great Lakes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His latest piece is called Greasing Oil's Path. Dan, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Well, Dan, there are a lot of high-profile pipelines elsewhere in the country. Tell us about the Enbridge pipeline, how much of it is running through Wisconsin and what it's bringing.
Yeah, it's not a pipeline. It's a cluster of pipelines that carries some 2 million barrels per day, a little more than that, and will soon be able to carry another 300,000 barrels per day through the length of Wisconsin. And for a little perspective, I think the Keystone XL is going to have, if it's built, a maximum capacity of 830,000 barrels per day. So we're looking at, you know, approaching three times that coming through Wisconsin already, with the potential for more.
And talk about arrangements with private property owners. The pipeline has to run in a more or less straight line, I guess, and sometimes that's going to take it through private property. How has that been arranged in the past?
Well, in the past, I mean, there's an easement. It's 80 feet wide, running from Superior to the Illinois border, more than 300 miles. And this easement was secured decades ago, most of it in the 1960s, I believe. And most of it was done with willing partnerships with property owners. The pipeline company would give these property owners a fee to have the right to lay these pipes through their land. The problem is this easement is now maxed out. It can't hold any more pipes. So unless they start removing pipes, they'd have to expand it. Now, to be clear, Enbridge is not saying that they're planning an expansion at the moment, but they have said in the past that they are considering a new pipeline, one that could theoretically have the capability of carrying 1.2 million barrels per day. And they have done surveys along this easement on the private properties that straddle it, which is the first step that it would take to do an easement expansion. Now, in most cases, I would guess that the company is going to be able to reach new deals with today's property owners. But in the cases where they don't, then they have to go to the Public Service Commission and, through eminent domain, condemn that property. And what the legislature did recently, I mean, some people will argue it's a tweak, but it's a tweak that was specifically asked for by Enbridge lobbyists, and that was to allow business entities, such as limited liability partnerships, to use this power, this awesome power, to claim private land. Previously, the way the state law was worded, it was only corporations, but the Enbridge entity that would be seeking to acquire this property, these easements, it operates as a limited liability partnership. So they changed the wording, and that was probably done because in 2008, the Public Service Commission granted Enbridge the authority to claim some easements on private property. But one of the members, the commission members, said, you know, technically, you're not a corporation, and there was a lot of ambiguity in this, and she ended up finding that because they also have a corporation status in another company operating in the state that was somehow involved, she said that they would give it to him this time, but next time it may not be so easy, so they changed the law.
Talking to Dan Egan from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about pipelines and private property rights. And Dan, you wrote about a couple conflicts in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Can you first tell us about one that happened in Superior, where a man was arrested for trespassing on his own lot?
Yeah, he was trying to stop construction of a pipeline that his family had not consented to, and Enbridge made the argument that their existing easement gave them the right to do this. This is in an area above Enbridge's oil distribution center. So when I was talking about this 80-foot easement, that runs out of the distribution center. This was an easement that runs into it. It only runs about across, you know, maybe 14 miles of Wisconsin land coming in from Minnesota. Anyway, it's not as wide, and the family It did not consent to have this pipeline laid in 2009, and Enbridge went ahead and did it anyway, and it ended up in court. Well, first of all, when the family's son, a 29-year-old at the time, I believe, tried to stop the construction, he was arrested. He was put in handcuffs and hauled off to jail for trespassing on his own property. Those charges were subsequently dropped. The family took their case to court, and they ended up winning. And it was decided that no, Enbridge didn't have the right under their existing easement to lay this pipeline, but the line was already in the ground. They considered it a mistake. They awarded the family some, I can't remember the figure, I think it might have been $150,000 total, but the pipeline is still running today. So that was one conflict, and there was another one that we talk about in the story that happened out in North Dakota, and it was another Enbridge pipeline that would have been coming into Superior, and this gentleman happens to live in Wisconsin now, but he owns property in North Dakota, and he refused to give Enbridge an easement, and he took it all the way to the North Dakota Supreme Court, where Enbridge backed off because they ended up deciding not to build that pipeline.
So with eminent domain, this is where Enbridge would go, as you say, to the Public Service Commission and look for the ability to use this property, whether the owner wants it or not. What did the legislature, when they changed this law, weigh in on whether this is a power that should be used more than it currently is?
No, I haven't been able to get legislative leadership to talk about it at all. And the only reason that, we know Enbridge was behind this push is because of an open records request by Wisconsin Public Radio. So thanks for the good work. I don't know what their motives were or what the idea was behind it, but, you know, nobody doubts that we need oil. We need oil as much as we need electricity, as much as we need schools, and those are commonly, projects that are commonly relying on eminent domain. But the question is how much oil, because not all of this oil is staying in the state or even the region or even in the country. I mean, Enbridge has shipped oil out of the Gulf of Mexico. They've reversed the line that used to flow into Sarnia, which is just northeast of Detroit. So now it flows out of Sarnia to the Canadian East Coast. So the argument from a lot of people opposed to these lines is that Wisconsin's being asked to bear, a risk. It can be debated how significant, but pipelines do leak, as one did just a couple of days ago. And to a limited, the argument goes, economic benefit. This is Canadian oil headed toward Canadian or other offshore countries.
And a lot of times concerns about pipelines are for environmental risks, like possible leaks, as you just mentioned. When you were talking to property owners, some of them say, hey, I'm not an environmentalist. They're worried about their property rights when it comes to eminent domain.
Absolutely, yeah. I talked. There was a gathering in Madison back in May with about 50 people who live along the existing easement, and then they showed up to make it known that they do not support the idea of Enbridge being able to claim more use of their property. And these were not people, or this was not a group entirely composed of people opposed to the idea of tar sands oil coming out of Canada and going into American gas tanks. These were a number of self-described conservatives who just don't think that a for-profit foreign company should be, taking the property rights of Wisconsin residents.
As you mentioned earlier, Dan, Enbridge is not currently looking to try to use eminent domain to get to these easements, but has indicated it wants to expand its pipeline capacity in Wisconsin. Do you have a sense of what kind of timeline there would be if Enbridge wanted to bring up that capacity?
Well, there's so much at play right now. There is a pipeline under construction, and there's some arrests just last week from some protesters up in Superior. There's a new pipeline. The plan is for it to come from Alberta, from the tar sands, through Minnesota into Wisconsin. It's been approved in Canada. It's been approved in Wisconsin. It's being built in both places, but the state of Minnesota has yet to sign off on it and won't do so or won't make a decision on it until April. If this pipeline gets built, it's probably going to put more pressure on Enbridge to push more oil through the length of Wisconsin, because it's just like a river. You can't increase upstream flows without increasing downstream flows. So how this shakes out in Minnesota will be really interesting, especially, you know, given the recent news just today that the Nebraska Public Service Commission has approved the Keystone XL. And, you know, these are two pipelines coming from basically the same place, carrying basically the same product. And, you know, it's not known right now if both of them are needed. So maybe Keystone XL gets built if Minnesota doesn't approve the Enbridge line.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Dan Egan, reporter covering the Great Lakes from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us for a look at oil pipelines in Wisconsin and private property rights. First, in the last few years, you may have noticed the rise and fall of the pumpkin spice latte, frozen yogurt, even cupcakes. They're foods that seem to start off trendy, but after a period of time, they become the target of eye rolls and mockery. Our next guest says that the food trends that are most likely to be made fun of are the ones associated with women. In an article for Taste magazine called Women Aren't Ruining Food, she argues that food trends associated with women are looked down on, but the ones associated with men, things like craft beer or protein shakes, get taken more seriously. Jaya Saxena is a writer, editor, and author based in New York. She joins us now. Jaya, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, how do people accuse women of ruining different kinds of food and beverages?
I mean, I think it happens the same way that people accuse women of ruining anything. You know, people accuse women of ruining Ghostbusters. It's just that we tend to have this aversion to women having an enthusiasm for anything. And so I think that, right, when you have something that becomes very trendy, like cupcakes or like rosé, and people see that it's a majority women who are enjoying these things, that tends to rankle them a little more than if there is some overarching trend, but men were the ones enjoying it.
Who is getting rankled here? Because I imagine women are perfectly fine with a food
right.
being associated with women. So I guess it's us, the guys, who see, oh, now this is a women food. I can't touch that. Is that basically what's happening?
Yeah, I think it happens where either, you know, it's easy for men to belittle something, or men feel the need to maybe reclaim something. I think one of the standard ones in rosé that you see is a lot of men being like, actually, rosé is a very complex and interesting drink, and it's not just for sorority girls. And trying to, assuming that their enjoyment of something adds legitimacy to it. When really enjoying whatever food you want was perfectly legitimate already, no matter who you were.
Yeah, why would we gender food in the first place?
You know, I think like I was saying before, we gender things all the time in ways that we don't even know. I mean, already the color pink is assumed for girls and the color blue is assumed for boys. And if you take a second to think about that, it's pretty absurd that we have decided that certain colors are for certain genders. And so that happens every place in our life, and food is certainly no different.
And it's interesting that it moves over time where, like you said, with rosé or something like that, people see it as a women's thing for a while, and then men start to actively, colonize it, kind of, to reclaim it in its masculine, manly ways?
A little bit. I think that there's a certain aspect because, right, something like rosé, obviously it's for anyone to enjoy. But I think that there's a lot of understanding in our culture that if a woman likes something and it's considered a woman's item and then a man starts liking it, he needs to justify that in some way. Because, really, we do not like men who aspire to act like women. We assume that women should aspire to act like men, and we don't think it should be the other way around. So if a man is going to like rosé or some other food item or any item that has been associated with women, he needs to justify it in a certain way. And so I think that men, when they find themselves enjoying something like rosé, which they absolutely should, it's great, they have to do all of this mental gymnastics to justify it by saying, well, it's not because I'm a woman or I'm acting like a woman. It's really because it's much more complicated and interesting and more for men than you really thought.
And you write that this plays into marketing. In order to sell I'll put it in quotes, women's foods to men, they have to market it in a manly way.
Yeah. One of the most interesting ones I've seen recently is there are a couple different yogurt brands that are starting to market yogurt as sort of a powerlifting, protein-filled workout food. That eating a cup of yogurt for breakfast, you're getting your protein fill, you're going to build muscle this way. The packaging is black and red instead of sort of the pastels that are usually used in yogurt. And again, it's like there's nothing about yogurt that is for any gender over another. We just have wrapped ourselves into some ridiculous circles in the way that I think gender just does this to people.
Did you use the word brogurt in your piece? That's in my head, and I'm not clever enough to have thought of it myself.
It was just such a silly one to see because I really felt like yogurt. I really thought that yogurt was neutral. I really did not realize that this was what was happening in the yogurt world until I took a closer look. And I was just like, ah, darn, yogurt too, huh?
We're talking to Jaya Saxena. She's a writer. She wrote a piece on how women are often seen as ruining different kinds of foods for men, making them seem unmasculine. And Jaya, is this ironic since, I mean, at least according to numbers I've seen, and I think you cite, women do a lot of the food purchasing. And, you know, women historically are viewed as the ones who are the food makers, processors, cookers, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. I think that a huge part of also the way we look at food, it's not just who gets to eat what, but right, who's making it, who's providing it. And it's this interesting thing where we sort of expect women to be homemakers in a certain sense, to be the ones who are conscious of food and health. But we also criticize women a lot for what they eat. We criticize women for eating too much. We criticize women for eating in ways that we view as unhealthy. We very much police women's bodies and expect them to be skinny and fit. And this certainly touches men, too. But traditionally, I think that we've turned most of this attention to women. So we're already really, really scrutinizing whatever women decide to put in their bodies. And this is just one more way that we do that, either criticizing women for getting excited about a certain type of food, criticizing women for perhaps taking a food away from men in ways that, you know, right, that's not actually what's going on. But, you know, if women start liking certain types of beer, then people get very territorial about it. I mean, yeah, there are a lot of ways in which we tend to judge women around food, and this is just one more aspect of that.
And let's talk about food and drink fussiness. I think of the scene in When Harry Met Sally with the, you know, the really precise delineation of what has to be on Meg Ryan's sandwich, or
yeah,
the stock character, the woman at the coffee shop ordering the half calf, blah, blah, blah. Okay, that gets made fun of. A guy being really particular about the percentage of hops in a craft beer, does that get the same kind of judgment?
Right. We do not call men fussy. I feel like that is one of those very gendered words in terms of criticisms. Or when we lobby it as a man, it's a way of accusing him of acting like a woman. But right, as I wrote in the piece for Taste Magazine, that a woman can have certain tastes, can want to make, you know, a beautiful smoothie bowl, can be very precise about ordering her salad with dressing on the side with all sorts of stuff in it, and we're saying, oh, you know, just relax. Why don't you just order a steak or something? And men can come up with these elaborate home brewing projects, curing meats in their closet, you know, being very precise about the exact levels of protein to fat they eat every day when they go work out to make sure their gains are enough. And no one is calling them fussy in the same way. Or if they're fussy, well, it's necessary. You know, that's because they're really smart and they're doing this interesting thing.
And there's a new trend you point out. So men don't diet, they biohack.
They biohack. Yeah, that is a term I believe I first heard in conjunction with Soylent, which is essentially a meal replacement shake, the same way that, you know, Slim Fast or Muscle Milk or any of these things have been meal replacement shakes that have existed for a very long time. But instead, they're saying, well, it's science that you're getting all of your nutrients in this one beverage and you don't need anything else, and we're hacking our bodies. Versus women drinking a Slim Fast is considered dieting. But really, the promises of both those products are very similar, and in both ways, you're accomplishing the same thing. I think biohacking, another example, is that there are a bunch of men who have been talking about fasting, that they'll fast on and off days, and that this is somehow, you know, really good for their productivity and doing all these great things for their body. And I'm like, you're just not eating. That's dieting. That's what women have been told to do forever.
And Jaya, as we wrap up, I think I'm ahead of the curve in some ways because I drink so-called manly drinks. I'll happily drink a pink drink with an umbrella without shame. I love cupcakes. I mean, should we all just eat what we want to eat within, you know, the limits of our health?
Right. I think that, you know, obviously if you are a man who only likes whiskey and beer, that's totally fine. And if you're a woman who only drinks pink drinks, that's also totally fine. You're allowed to like what you like. I just think it's a matter of taking a moment to question maybe why you like that. Is it because you genuinely like the taste, or is there something that has been keeping you from trying other things? And, you know, no matter where you land, that's okay.
Jaya, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jaya Saxena is a writer, editor, and author based in New York. She joined us to talk about her article, Women Aren't Ruining Food. First, the Department of Urban and Regional Planning at UW-Madison got a lot of attention over the weekend. The Wisconsin State Journal published an article about the department's struggle with sexual harassment surrounding a prominent professor. The article says the professor's alleged conduct had long been known in the so-called whisper network of women in the department. A survey on sexual misconduct at UW-Madison in 2015 revealed that about half of the responding female graduate students had experienced sexual harassment during their time at the university. About one in five of those who experienced harassment said a faculty member was responsible for the misconduct. Shannon Roski is an assistant professor in the College of Business at UW-Oshkosh. She joins us now for a look at sexual harassment on college campuses. Shannon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, with all the news of high-profile sexual harassment cases around the state, are you surprised to hear a story right here in Wisconsin on a big university campus?
You know, I've been studying sexual harassment for just about a decade now, and anytime I talk to anyone about my research, it seems that everyone has a personal story of either experiencing or being accused of sexual harassment. So at this point in my career, I'm never surprised to hear about a new instance of sexual harassment.
How big of a problem is sexual harassment on college and university campuses in particular?
It's definitely an issue. About 62% of all college students, that's including male and female students, experience some form of sexual harassment while in college. And that's only considering the students. College campuses are also a workplace for faculty and staff. And we know that one in three women and about one in 15 men will experience sexual harassment at some point in their careers.
Is it a particular problem on college campuses? It seems like we're learning every day that it's a problem everywhere in every walk of life in this country. Is there something unique about it on college campuses?
Well, research suggests that there are certain factors like power differences or organizational cultures that might tolerate unprofessional or sexual behaviors that will then lead to sexual harassment. And if you think about college campuses, some of those factors are observable. So, for instance, there are power differences among administration, faculty, staff, and students. There are certain populations on campus, for instance, especially younger populations that might not have developed a sense of professionalism. Students might struggle to understand which behaviors might constitute harassment coming in out of high school, where certain things might be funny in friend groups, but they don't understand how it might impact someone's working or learning environment. Some of my recent research on sexual harassment also suggests that employees who frame sexual behaviors as playful or funny, that can blind people to the potential harm of these behaviors and thus perpetuate more frequent and more severe sexual behaviors being exhibited in the workplace.
In the UW-Madison case we referred to, the Wisconsin State Journal talked to two women who said they had experienced sexual harassment but wanted to remain anonymous because of fears of retaliation. Is that a common feeling to have?
So there are laws and university policies that are going to protect people from retaliation for reporting sexual harassment, even if that claim of sexual harassment cannot be substantiated with evidence. So if a person was retaliated against, that could be the source of a new harassment claim. There's the law, of course, and policy, but then there's also the real reality of experiencing retaliation. So even though there are protections against this, someone who's experiencing sexual harassment might still recognize, if I report, I could then be a target for retaliation, and thus they do the cost-benefit analysis and determine it's not worth it to them to make a formal report, even if the organization protects them from retaliation after it occurs.
Shannon Roski is with us from UW Oshkosh. We're talking about sexual harassment on college campuses and elsewhere. And Shannon, a lot of your research focuses on the impact of sexual harassment trainings at the workplace, which is often offered as a solution when these problems arise. What have you learned about sexual harassment training and what kind of impact it can have?
Well, what's most interesting about the research on sexual harassment training is there's very little of it. So in terms of best practices, we don't know much as an academic community about what organizations should be doing in training. Some of the research is showing that there are benefits in terms of knowledge gained and maybe avoidance of certain behaviors. Other studies show there's no effect of sexual harassment training. And in particular, a study that I conducted looked at some worst case scenario effects of sexual harassment training. So I found that some employees who go through sexual harassment training were threatened by it. And afterwards, they ended up forming intentions to engage in more sexual behaviors in the workplace. They also formed intentions to avoid employees that they thought would be potential victims of sexual harassment and seek out employees who they thought would be potential harassers. So almost like creating subgroups within their work environment for people who would support the enactment of these sexual behaviors and avoiding those who wouldn't. And of course, that would pose issues in terms of sex-based discrimination in the workplace when you have the most vulnerable employees being the ones socially ostracized.
So it's a how-to guide in some cases for sexual harassers?
I wouldn't say that. What's happening, what I found in my study is that employees form norms in their work group before training happens. And so you might have a work group where people are already engaging in, let's say, sexual joke telling and have agreed amongst each other that this behavior is okay. Then they walk into training and they feel as though the training's pointing a finger at them and saying, you know, if you're involved in these sexual behaviors at work, you're either a harasser or a victim. Nobody wants to be either one of those roles. They're both negative roles to play. So this certain group of employees will backlash against the message of training. They'll deem the training illegitimate, a waste of their time, something that doesn't need to be listened to. And then when they return to work, in order to prove how illegitimate the training is, they'll engage in those sexual behaviors all the more to prove that they're okay in the workplace.
Is there something that works better or a better kind of sexual harassment training approach that avoids that reaction?
So we're still trying to figure out best practices in the research, but based on my prior results, I would recommend going with a more bystander-focused training. As I mentioned, it seems like this particular group of employees who's threatened by training is threatened by those negative roles that are imposed. When the trainer has a very harasser or victim-centric focus, they feel like those are the only roles somebody can play in a sexual harassment scenario. But the bystander role is a potentially really positive role to play. You can cover the same exact training content. For instance, here's a definition of harassment. Here are some behaviors to watch out for. And the difference might be instead of pointing your finger at the trainees and saying, don't do those behaviors, instead telling the trainees, hey, if you see anyone engaging in this in the workplace, here's some proactive ways you can intervene and stop that harm from happening. So instead of assuming all of the trainees are going to be harassers assume that they're all potential bystanders and can actually help the organization create a better work environment.
And that seems like it would solve another problem where we hear of sexual harassment being reported informally or formally and being in some ways swept under the rug, maybe because the person it's reported to doesn't know how to be a positive bystander.
It's possible. Not everybody has the human resource management training to know what to do with a particular report of sexual harassment, especially if you're not in any kind of management position. You might just think, oh, they're just telling me this, and I'm not sure what to do with the information. That's why training can be really beneficial, because if we treat all of our employees as potential bystanders, we can give them training to say, here's how you could intervene in an ongoing harassment situation. Here's what you could do to help someone understand how to navigate the reporting system if they report sexual harassment to you after the fact, even if you're not particularly in a management position or if your job doesn't require you to be responsible for managing sexual harassment claims. We can still put employees in positive roles that help create a better culture around these issues.
We're talking to Shannon Roski from UW Oshkosh about sexual harassment on college campuses and about sexual harassment training and prevention in general. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced or witnessed sexual harassment on campus? How did you address the behavior if you're on campus often? What's the climate like in your department? What do you think we need to do to stop sexual harassment on campus and elsewhere? Have you been through a training that you thought was particularly effective or ineffective? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about sexual harassment on college campuses and elsewhere now with Shannon Roski from UW Oshkosh. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think college campuses can address problems of sexual harassment? What would need to change to create a more positive climate, a place where harassment is addressed and prevented on campus? And have you been through sexual harassment training, maybe at the workplace, maybe in school? What worked? What do you think didn't work? Call 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. And Shannon, let's get into that power imbalance you mentioned earlier. On a university campus, a professor with a grad student, maybe a thesis advisor, they have a lot of power over that person's career. They can single-handedly almost scuttle someone's career. Is that part of the solution, trying to deal with that power imbalance?
Yes, I think when you think of sexual harassment, what you have to realize is that power, not sexual interest, is the main motivator behind these inappropriate sexual behaviors. And so you might have a professor who holds formal power over, let's say, a student's grades. And if they make a sexual advance, they don't need to necessarily state an explicit exchange, you know, comply with this or I won't pass you in the class. It's implied just by the sheer fact that they hold so much power over a student. But power can also come out in ways you might not expect. So there's lots of informal forms of power, such as someone's popularity, expertise, or even their physical strength. For instance, I know of a case of sexual harassment on a college campus outside the state of Wisconsin where a university staff member was being harassed by male students while carrying out her janitorial work in the dorms. So even though she's an adult female with an official job at the university, her lower social class in comparison to the college students made her a target for mistreatment because she was the lower power individual in the scenario.
I want to bring on a caller now. John is with us in Indianapolis. John, hi.
When I was in graduate school, it was a professor who was having a lot of affairs with female students, and everybody on campus knew about it, including the faculty and administration, and he was tenured, and they said they couldn't touch him, but it was very disturbing that kind of behavior was going on campus that was visible and then also off campus.
John, thanks for the call. A couple points maybe to get to there, Shannon. First, the idea of a tenured professor, especially if it's a big-name, high-profile professor, being unenforceable, basically, in the eyes of a university.
So I think that's a common misconception about tenure. Tenure is really there to protect the academic freedom of professors. So that means that the university can fire you for whatever it is that you're researching in particular. For instance, the university couldn't fire me for investigating sexual harassment training on college campuses. But tenure does not protect a professor from mistreating or abusing students or other employees of the university. In fact, a university or organizations in general are required to protect individuals from that form of mistreatment. So whether it's a big name, a celebrity type individual or not, the organization is still responsible for investigating claims of sexual harassment and managing them. So celebrity is not an excuse or a get out of jail free card, so to speak.
But as we've seen again and again, that responsibility may not be taken up. In a lot of cases, this, as the caller mentioned, this open secret might be tolerated for years, decades even.
It's possible that what's resulting, and it's hard to know without knowing the specific details of the case, but oftentimes the bind the organization is in is they'll investigate and find that there's no evidence to make that claim legally actionable. So it's not that the organization is unaware or trying to sweep something under the rug. It's just that based on the laws and the organization's policies, there might not be any sort of disciplinary action that could potentially happen. And with something like a consensual romantic relationship like an affair, the issue might not necessarily be sexual harassment with the affair partner, but more of a conflict of interest with those outside of that romantic relationship. So perhaps the affair partner is getting special treatment because of that romantic relationship.
And Shannon, I wanted to ask about the role of the Human Resources Department. I think there's a suspicion sometimes, we saw this a lot in the case of sexual harassment at Uber, that HR is there to protect the company, not to protect the employee. Who does HR, a Human Resources Department, really represent in these situations?
So I can't speak for how every HR department sees themselves in terms of whether they are there to protect the employees or the company. And I do have some colleagues that would reasonably disagree with me, but I teach all of my HR students that their role in HR is to do both. By protecting the employees from mistreatment and abuse, or even just bothersome interactions at work, we are going to create a healthier, happier workforce that is then more productive for the company. And this mentality will also help HR avoid unwanted lawsuits as well.
And Shannon, it seems like in the long run, we see case after case where the secret is prevented with the eye on, you know, avoiding a scandal in the short run. But when that scandal comes out a year or a decade later, it's even worse because they didn't deal with it up front.
Oh, absolutely. So the reputational consequences of organizations that are very publicly known to have a climate that tolerates sexual harassment, those are serious consequences for that organization. So you could see less interest in individuals wanting to work for your company. Of course, the cost of lawsuits, a less productive workforce, which of course costs the company money. So there are many costs to having that negative reputation.
Very briefly, Shannon, are you hoping for a silver lining in all these cases that everybody's going to be thinking more closely about how they handle these issues?
I guess if there is any silver lining in reports of this type of mistreatment, that would be it, that there's an increased motivation to research this subject, to find what the best practices are, and to help make workplaces and college campuses safer and healthier for everyone.
We'll leave it there. Shannon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Shannon Roski is an assistant professor in the College of Business at UW-Oshkosh. She joined us to look at sexual harassment on college campuses and elsewhere after an article detailing one department at UW-Madison that has struggled with sexual harassment issues. Wisconsin has the nation's second highest rate of deadly falls among those 65 and older. A program to prevent falls has been shown to work, but relatively few who could benefit from it are using it. Shemaine Mills reports.
It's been called an epidemic. Despite its sometimes deadly consequences, falls among the elderly often get less attention than other pressing health concerns. But health officials around the state say falls are taking a financial and physical toll that can't be ignored, especially in a state that's older than most. Jane Mahoney, a UW-Madison professor of geriatrics, says the death rate from serious spills has increased since 2000.
Fall-related emergency department visits have also increased over that time. And there are many reasons for this, but one of this is just the sheer numbers related to the aging of the population.
To drive home her point during a health presentation, she shows a state map. It illustrates what percentage of residents in each county are 65 or older. In 2010, that was about 14%.
Look what happens for 2030.
It's a demographic eclipse. The map changes from mostly light to dark. Just over a decade from now, over a quarter of the state's residents will be elderly, with fewer people to care for them.
So that is going to put a disproportionate burden of falls in our rural northern population.
It's a concern in every corner of the state. As residents get older, muscle loss and medication can cause instability that can lead to an ER visit or nursing home stay. Barb Michaels is with the Aging and Disability Resource Center in Brown County.
Falls are increasing in our county, and they're costly. It is our number one injury in Brown County.
In 2013, she said Green Bay's four hospitals treated an average of 21 serious falls a day at a cost of nearly $15 million a year. The number of patients and the cost have both increased. In 2016, there were 23 serious falls a day in Green Bay's ERs at a cost of nearly $19 million annually. The most widespread falls prevention program used in Wisconsin is called Stepping On. This fall, a group of seniors gathered at a Dane County gymnasium where they learned how to avoid serious spills. 81-year-old Evelyn Graff had an ACE bandage on her wrist and was using a walker to get around.
I have fallen so many times, I don't keep track anymore.
Graff says she's never broken any bones, but her older sister, 82-year-old Gladys Bookout, hasn't been so lucky. She and her husband, Bob, recalled a pair of falls, including an incident where she lost her footing in a parking lot and broke three ribs and punctured a lung.
First fall, it fractured your right hip, your arm, you tore up the rotator cuff in your shoulder.
See, but I just forgot about all those.
Gladys recovered physically and with her sense of humor intact. But Jane Mahoney with the UW-Madison School of Medicine says two-thirds of those hospitalized for falls will go to a nursing home for either a short or long-term stay. Some don't survive. Wisconsin's elderly death rate from falls is twice the national average. These sobering figures are why health providers want to get more elderly into falls prevention programs like Stepping On, which teach balance and strength exercises. Mahoney says a study of 3,000 Wisconsin seniors who took the program showed a 50% reduction in falls 6 months after participating.
In a subsequent study, we also found it reduced emergency department visits for falls by 70%. So very important.
But less than 1% of those at risk for falls have participated in Stepping On. Mahoney and others say it's not lack of interest, but limited public funding that's preventing more elderly from learning skills that could be life-saving. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.